Richard Louv's landmark book, Last Child in the Woods, inspired an international movement to connect children and nature. Now, he is looking to redefine the future of human-animal coexistence. The new book is Our Wild Calling, which explores these powerful and mysterious bonds and how they can transform our mental, physical, and spiritual lives, as well as serve as an antidote to the growing epidemic of human loneliness, and even help us tap into the empathy required to preserve life on Earth. Our Wild Calling makes the case for protecting, promoting, and creating a sustainable and shared habitat for all creatures, not out of fear, but out of love. The book looks to point us toward what to look for in this age of technology, which is a real connection. Again, the name of the new book is Our Wild Calling, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Louv back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. So was it a natural progression to look at this bond, this human-animal coexistence, of something that you have been thinking about for a while?
I actually was a kid once, and I thought about it a lot then when I was in the woods with my dog. I spent a lot of time in the woods with my dog. My dog knew where I was, but my parents didn't always. And I had, like a lot of folks, had a lot of connections with other animals, frogs and squirrels. There weren't any deer in those woods at that time. Outside of Kansas City, there are now. And I noticed as an adult over time that those interactions kind of disappeared for a while, but then they came back, and I found myself being really transported often by an encounter with eagles or, you know, even a pigeon on the street. And I started asking other folks about that, and they began to tell me stories. And hardcore scientists, traditional healers, teachers, kids and adults, everyone seems to have a story of an awe-inspiring encounter with another wild animal or a relationship ongoing with their pet, which has far more importance to us than I think we often give credit to those animals for.
For those who don't have those opportunities, who don't have those opportunities as much as those of us who live in more rural areas, I'm curious as to how you make the case for that connection and basically look at some of the building blocks of some of the beginnings to start those connections.
Well, sure. In Our Wild Calling, I talk about a couple things regarding that question. One is that birds happen to be just about everywhere. Now, the bad news is that there is a recent report that the number of birds in North America has decreased by almost 30% just in the last 50 years, just since 1970. But they're still there, and they're in urban areas as well as rural and suburban areas. So many people have those kind of connections with birds. But also, there's a section in Our Wild Calling called The Betweens, and it's about the fact that more and more wild animals are moving into cities. Ironically, just as I mentioned, the deer weren't in the suburban woods when I was a kid, but now they're there. Not only are deer outside of Kansas City, where I grew up, but mountain lions are coming down the Missouri River, across Missouri, across Kansas into Missouri, on to St. Louis even. And so we have a lot more wild animals around us in cities. Now, we have one of two choices. Either we can treat them like vermin and eradicate them, as some people want to do, or we can connect with them. But we can see this as a great benefit to our psychological health. Why is it when we talk about social capital, we only talk about one species? We're surrounded by a larger family, and connecting that family, as you mentioned, I think can go a long way toward dealing with this epidemic of human loneliness that medical folks are talking about now.
So help us connect those dots of where we are with loneliness and how this can help and how we can begin this to understand our coexistence and the importance for both species?
Well, the new concern about loneliness and social isolation is alarming a lot of medical people. It's now believed by many medical people that the impact of loneliness on human health is about to surpass obesity as an impact on human health. And it's not only because of suicide, it's because of many of the diseases that are attached to human isolation. A lot of that is because we spend too much time on antisocial media, and we spend less and less time face-to-face. Design of cities, design of neighborhoods doesn't encourage us to be with each other very much anymore. But I think that this human loneliness is also rooted in this, in a deeper kind of loneliness, which is species loneliness. The urban parks, for example, that have the best benefit for psychological health and well-being for human beings happen to be the parks with the highest biodiversity, the most variety of plants and animals. I don't think that's an accident. I think as a species, we are desperate not to feel alone in the universe. And by connecting to the animals around us, the wild animals, the increasing number of pets in U.S. households, that is not only a way to feel less isolated, but some of the programs that, for instance, teach bird language, that teach people how to connect to other animals, find that the people go home and they treat their spouse better. Suddenly they realize they're listening to their husband or listening to their wife. And there are more and more of those kind of programs now occurring.
You talk in the book about how a single encounter with a wild animal or even long-term companionship with a domesticated animal, of how transformative that can be.
Yeah, there are many, many stories in the book that people sent to me. I was amazed that once you opened that door, a lot of people want to tell you stories. Most of your listeners probably have some kind of story about an encounter with a wild animal or a relationship with a pet that has changed their life. And so many of these stories, for instance, one is about an encounter with an octopus, a famous oceanographer. Another one is one that a woman tells me about in Toronto, told me about going into the living room once, and her son, a young 6-year-old son, was stretched out on the floor with their dog, a big dog named Jack. And she heard her son say, "Mommy, I don't have a heart anymore." Mm. And she says, "What are you saying?" And her son quietly said, with his arm around the dog named Jack, he said, "My heart is in Jack." That permeability, that connection that we do have, that we often have when we're kids, but then begin to forget, is still there and still possible. In the book, I call this the habitat of the heart. It's not really in the other animal. It's in the other animal. It's in us, but it's between us. It's that permeability. It's that connection that Martin Buber, the great intellectual, always have to be careful not to say Justin Bieber, but the great intellectual Martin Buber called that a kind of electricity that exists between people when they make that connection, that relationship that some people call God, he said. In the book, when we talk about our connection with other animals, I call that the habitat of the heart.
That connection, that habitat of the heart, both sides are beneficiaries in that equation, aren't they?
I believe so. Now, we can't speak for the other animal. Anthropomorphism has its downsides, obviously. We don't want to assume what the other animal is thinking. But sometimes we can feel that. Certainly we can feel that with dogs. But I think that we can feel what's between us and the other animal. Now, it has the benefit, if we care about that animal, if we come to care about animals because of that relationship, we will do more to protect them.
You write in the book about what some scientists call critical anthropomorphism. What is that, and how do we practice that?
There's a scientist named Gordon Burkhoff who came up with that phrase, critical anthropomorphism, several years ago. And for some reason, herpetologists are particularly like this idea. And basically what he says is that if you're going to study a snake as a scientist, you need to sit with the snake. You have to be with the snake. He has a funny phrase, he says, you have to wear the shoes of the snake. And by that, he means when you're with that animal and intending to study it, first you apply in your mind all the hard science that you know about how that snake perceives the world. The second step is to use your imagination to try to imagine what it's like to be that snake, not to project human characteristics into the snake, but try to understand that snake by, in a sense, becoming a snake. Now, he makes the case, and I think it's a strong case, that if you want to ask great questions, great scientific questions about other animals, critical anthropomorphism is a step that needs to be taken. I'd love to see that taught in schools. I mean, think how many kids have lost interest in biology or science at some point. It often happens around fifth grade, because it all becomes math. It's no longer about feeling and wonder. I think critical anthropomorphism is a way to scientifically achieve that.
Richard Louv is the author of Our Wild Calling. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Richard, thank you very much for sharing with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. Again, Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods, his new book is Our Wild Calling. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.